I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to Words on a Wire. Today, I have a very special guest. He's not a poet. He's not a fiction writer, a playwright, a memoirist. He is a writer, philosopher, and he just came out with a best-selling book called Galileo's Error, Foundations for a New Science of Consciousness. And in this book, he is doing, among other things, explaining panpsychism. What is panpsychism? It is the idea that perhaps one of the fundamental elements of reality, of the universe, rather than being time and space or matter, is consciousness itself. He's a very interesting philosopher, professor in the UK, and one of the most important philosophers of our time. I'm very, very excited to have a conversation with Philip Goff. So stick around.
Words on a wire.
Words on a wire. Wire.
Hello.
Hi. Oh, it looks like you have a magical crown on your head.
This is my shirt. It actually looks like spots, but if you look very closely, it's assorted.
Whales.
It's assorted poultry.
Oh, poultry. I thought it was whales. Cool. I got a Keeping It Curious shirt on. Curious George.
Very good. Very good. I like it.
Absolutely. That's what's important for philosophers and poets alike, right? Curiosity. Insight.
So you're a poet?
Well, when I use the term poets, I don't like to make a distinction between poets and fiction writers.
All right.
I'm a fiction writer. All my books are in fiction, but I like to use the term poets because there was a certain point, like natural philosophy and philosophy, where it was split asunder.
Right.
So I like to say poets to indicate anybody who follows language to arrive at some sort of work of art or something, something ineffable, I guess.
That's nice. I should call scientists philosophers.
Absolutely. I think so. And I think one of the things your book is doing is it's bringing science back to philosophy where I think it needs to be, frankly.
That's the hope.
Yeah. So why don't we just start off, if you don't mind? You're the very first philosopher I've had on the show. I've been doing this show for 11 years, and I've had poets and I've had fiction writers. I've actually even had a few neuroscientists and a few physicists on the show, because occasionally I like to dabble in those kind of explanations of reality. Uh-huh. Which I find incredibly liberating for the imagination when I read a book like yours. But you're the first philosopher I've ever had. So maybe if we could start off by talking about how does one become a philosopher?
Oh, well, that's fine. Well, I feel honored to be the first philosopher on the podcast. Well, I guess there aren't many professional philosophers outside of academia, although there are some. Right. Yeah, there are a few who make a profession just through writing philosophy, but I guess principally, if you're a professional philosopher, it's an academic post like any other. But I guess in my case, you know, I've just always been totally obsessed with philosophy as far back as I can remember. And my parents tell me when I was four, I asked, "Why are we here?" But actually, we had just moved house, so uh-huh. I think maybe I was just confused about the location.
Oh, that's
but
funny.
Yeah, I guess I've always been, you know, I think for me it's sort of an obsession about kind of how things fit together. Uh-huh. Like, so, for example, I was raised Catholic, and I, at a very young age, again, I remember asking the priest, you know, where were Adam and Eve when the Big Bang happened? So it was sort of like, right. I was hearing these two stories of our origins. And, you know, how do they fit together? You know, so it's another thing that frustrated me as a kid, the fact that Superman, this might sound kind of ridiculous, but I think it expresses the fact that Superman could push a planet with ease, but mm-hmm. struggled a bit to lift a van. And, you know, he could lift a van, uh-huh, but
right.
That sort of doesn't make sense. You know, it doesn't fit together. Right. Like an urge to fit things together. I think actually I thought I wanted to be a physicist. I was into, you know, black holes and, you know, the start of the universe and stuff. And my parents actually sent me to a family friend who was a physicist to talk to him about physics when I was quite little. But I was just asking questions like, but does God exist? And he was like, I think you're in the wrong place here. So yeah, I mean,
nonetheless, you very obviously have dabbled in physics. You know, you seem to be able to explain a lot when it comes to, like, for example, you can talk about entanglement and Schrodinger's equation and all these different metaphors of physics. So how deeply have you gone into it? And have you gone as far as the math or mostly the I guess what we could call the metaphors of physics?
No, actually, one of my biggest regrets in life was not doing math or maths, as we call it, past the age of 16. And that is a huge regret for me. I was, you know, kind of, I actually wanted to drop out of school and become a rock star. So I didn't really take any serious subjects. And it is a miracle I carried on into academia, actually. But I guess, yeah, I mean, I've talked a lot to physicists and philosophers of physics, Barry Lohr at Rutgers, and physicists like Sean Carroll and Lee Smolin. I'm actually quite pleased there's going to be a special issue of the Journal of Consciousness Studies being published in October, which is going to be essays in response to my book, Galileo's Error.
Oh, really?
About today. But it's going to be really interdisciplinary. So it's not just philosophers. There are also physicists like Carlo Rovelli, Sean Carroll, Lee Smolin, some neuroscientists like Christoph Koch, and also some theologians, actually. So it's going to be really interesting. And yeah, I mean, Sean Carroll's is amazing. You know, he's a totally opposite viewpoint to me. He's not a panpsychist like I am, but you know, really gets the philosophy. I mean, this is the problem. Everything's so specialized these days.
Right.
It's hard to. I'm jealous of people in the 17th century where you could understand the cutting edge philosophy and science and mathematics. But you know, it's so specialized. Right. It's really hard to know enough about all these things to connect them up. So people like Sean Carroll are really trying to connect things up. And actually, Elise Smolin, who's a leading physicist, is inclined to think that actually a theory of consciousness in a panpsychist vein may actually shed light on some of these deep mysteries in physics, like how to reconcile relativity and quantum mechanics. So, and he's talking about that in this special issue. So that's really interesting. So yeah, so I guess I feel from talking to physicists and philosophers of physics, I've got a grip on the philosophical issues behind physics, you know, if not the mathematical details.
Well, it seems to me that the thing that philosophy, physics, and neuroscience have in common, and I would even include poetry in this, although that might be a little bit harder to justify, is that there is this search for unity. You know, like everybody wants to know, you know, is there a God particle or is there a consciousness, you know? And so it seems like these three fields are completely inseparable. You can't have one without the other.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I suppose it depends on your view of consciousness. Someone I have quite heated debates on Twitter with is the neurophilosopher Patricia Churchland. There was an article in the Irish Times actually about a Twitter argument we had.
That
was
really?
So she's of the opinion, you know, we just stop all this philosophy nonsense, just do the neuroscience. It's just an emergent feature of the brain. You know, stop wasting your time with all this philosophy.
She's a materialist.
Yeah, she's quite a hardcore material. Well, she made her name back in the 80s with her husband, Paul Churchland, for defending eliminative materialism, the view that one day neuroscience will just replace talk of mind and consciousness. So we'll no longer talk of, you know, beliefs and desires and hopes and fears. We'll just talk about physical processes in the brain. I think she's gone back from that a little bit now, but that was famous position she was famous for defending. She's actually just agreed to come on my podcast, Mind Chat, actually, which should be interesting, where we could actually, we'll probably be really polite to each other, actually, when we're actually.
Oh, I'm sure.
But yeah, so coming back, sorry, I've got going in a little bit of a long.
That's okay. That's what we do when we follow language. We go into all kinds of different beautiful geometric shapes.
Coming back from the detour. So, you know, if you have that kind of view, then probably, as she often says, you know, physics is just totally irrelevant. But if, like me, actually, you think consciousness is in some sense a fundamental feature of reality, and that we need to rethink our conception of science in order to deal with consciousness, then you're really going to have to be doing physics. So I think, you know, we do really need to deal with consciousness. We do really need to bring together philosophers, neuroscientists and physicists to really, really make progress on this. But also with literature, I mean, I think if you're just trying to understand consciousness itself, I think the best way to do that is literature. You know, read James Joyce. Because consciousness is nothing other than what it's like to be a human being, what it's like to adopt the perspective of a human being. So if that's your interest, don't talk to a philosopher, to, you know, read some literature. I think the role of the philosopher is what we've talked about already, you know, how that fits into the scientific story, how the story of the human being from the inside, feelings and experiences, colors, sounds, smells, tastes, how that story of the human being from the inside fits together with the story science gives us of the body and the brain from the outside. And we're still sort of, there's still no consensus on how exactly we solve that ancient problem, which is, I guess, the mind-body problem.
You know, I was reading, I think it was, I could be wrong because my memory isn't, I don't store facts. I store meaning, I guess you could say. But I think it was Alkonin Goldberg's Wisdom Paradox, which is really an interesting book that argues that wisdom is essentially, you know, years of pattern accumulation. And, you know, after a while, rather than, you know, approach a problem, an immediate pattern comes to you and you understand how to deal with it. But one of the things that he suggested is that no matter how engaged you are in science or philosophy, that you should read a novel, at least, you know, on a very regular basis. And I think that's kind of reinforcing what you're saying about that, because a novel is consciousness of characters. Or like Philip Pullman said in that wonderful interview you had with him, I think your publisher put you in a room with Philip Pullman. He calls that the narrator a sprite. Right, this voice that can, you know, go from place to place. But one of the things that I guess really impressed me about that conversation you had with him was how you pointed out a passage in his Dark Materials where the doctor is talking about matter and dark, or I guess the idea is dark matter, but they call it dust, right? For her, it's dark matter, but she's having this conversation with dark matter. And she asked it, you know, are you matter or are you spirit? Are you angels? I think it was. So you could probably explain it better. Can you talk a little bit about what you said and how that relates to your work?
Yeah, well, actually, it wasn't the publisher who hooked us up. Actually, we hooked up on Twitter again, actually.
Oh, really?
I just noticed he was following me on Twitter, actually. And he broke into some philosophical dispute I was having with a good friend of mine, Keith Frankish, who's a philosopher who thinks consciousness doesn't exist.
It's an illusion.
We both agree that our conventional scientific approach can't account for consciousness. So my response to that is to say, well, we need to change our scientific approach. Whereas his response is to say, well, it doesn't exist. It's just like magic or fairy dust or something. And we're doing this podcast Mind Chat together, interviewing scientists and philosophers of consciousness. And, you know, in the spirit of reaching out across, you know, in our polarized times, reaching out across, you know, these disagreements and, So Philip Pullman entered into that dispute, and then we just started messaging and stuff, and decided to have that public conversation. So just look, So actually, I mean, I read, excuse me, I've got a bit of a sore throat. Right. I read His Dark Materials when I was quite young. And then after I hooked up with Philip Pullman, I looked back at it in preparation for our conversation. And I was amazed to find certain lines that that really seemed to capture my position. Well, maybe as a background, the reason there's been a resurgence of interest in the view I defend, known as panpsychism,
right,
is due to the rediscovery of certain really important work from the 1920s by the philosopher Bertrand Russell, and also the scientist Arthur Eddington developed these ideas as well. And they were kind of forgotten about for a long time, but in the last decade or 15 years, they've recently been rediscovered and causing quite a lot of excitement in academic philosophy. So their starting point was, which sounds kind of paradoxical when you first hear it, their starting point was physics doesn't really tell us what matter is. When I actually first heard that, right, I thought that's ridiculous. You know, you study physics, you learn about space and time, right, and matter. But their insight was actually, when you really look at what physics is telling us, it's just telling us what stuff does. It's just telling us about behavior, things like mass, charge, accelerate, these things are totally defined in terms of attraction, repulsion, resistance to acceleration. It's all about what stuff does. And yet, intuitively, at least, you know, there's more to what something does than what it is. So I sometimes like give a chess piece analogy. If you're playing chess, you're interested in what the pieces do, you know, what moves you can make, what pieces you can take. But if you're someone who collects high-end luxury chess pieces, then you're interested in the substance of the pieces themselves. You know, you want pieces made of gold or silver rather than plastic or cheap metal. So this is what philosophers sometimes call in this context the intrinsic nature of a thing, you know, what it is, considered independently of what it does, its isness. So coming back to fundamental particles, physics gives us really rich information about what they do, attraction, repulsion, resistance, acceleration, but it's just totally silent on their intrinsic nature. So physics tells us what an electron does, but not what it is.
Right.
This is sometimes called the problem of intrinsic natures. So the genius of Russell and Eddington, I think, in the 1920s was to connect this to the problem of consciousness and to bring these two problems together. So on the one hand, science is just giving us a purely quantitative description of the brain and seems to leave out the qualities of our experience, the colors, the sounds, right, the smells, and the taste. On the other hand, science is giving us this purely behavioral description of matter and leaving out its intrinsic nature.
Right.
So they kind of brought these together and formulated the bold hypothesis that, well, maybe the qualities of experience are the intrinsic nature of matter. So it's sort of like there's this hole in science. It's just telling us what stuff does, not what it is. We're looking for a place for consciousness in our scientific story. We've got this hole. Maybe we can put consciousness in the hole. So the result is a kind of panpsychism, that consciousness pervades the universe and is a fundamental feature of it. But it's sort of panpsychism stripped of any mystical or supernatural connotations. The idea that it's just matter, particles or fields, but it can be described from two perspectives. Physical science describes it from the outside in terms of its behavior, but from the inside in terms of its intrinsic nature, it's constituted of forms of consciousness. That's very long-winded, but coming back to Philip Pullman, I'll have to remember the exact line now, but when this character is talking to dust, it's sort of through a computer, it's this long-winded setup. And as you say, she says, are you spirit or matter? And they say something like, I can't remember the exact quote. In our being, we are spirit. In our action, we are matter. Spirit and matter are one. And that just sort of totally sums up.
Right. You could take action and replace it with behavior.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I can't remember what the exact word was now. Maybe it was behavior. But on the recent HBO series as well, they had that line.
I saw that. Yeah, that was my introduction to Philip Pullman. I had never heard of him before, but my wife has read all his books, and so she encouraged me to watch that that series. Yeah. I haven't read the books yet, but it seems like we're kind of entering into Galileo's era through a side door, and so maybe we could go back to just introducing the book itself. The title is Galileo's Era, Foundations for a New Science of Consciousness, and we'll get to the consciousness part, but can we talk a little bit about the meaning of the title? What was the error that Galileo made that is still affecting science and philosophy today?
Yeah, I think it's Galileo's to blame for all of this, really. I think Galileo is known as the father of modern science, and we think of him as this great experimental scientist, which of course he was, but he was also a philosopher, and people forget there's a philosophy behind science, and that was pretty much completely concocted by Galileo at the start of the scientific revolution. I think it's a philosophy we still operate with today. So because before Galileo, people following Aristotle thought that the physical world was filled with qualities. So there's sort of colors on the surfaces of objects, sounds and smells floating through the air, tastes actually inside food. But Galileo wanted science to be totally mathematical. And the problem there was these qualities, because it doesn't seem like you can capture these qualities in the purely quantitative language of mathematics. You know, an equation can't capture that deep red you experience when you watch the setting sun. So Galileo had to get around this by proposing, as a philosopher, a radically new philosophical worldview. And according to this, so this is an important part of the scientific revolution. It wasn't just moving to a more experimental method and the great discoveries like that the Earth goes around the sun rather than vice versa. It was also this radically new philosophical worldview. So according to this worldview, the qualities aren't really out there in the physical world. They're just in consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. So that if you're looking at a tomato or tomatoes, you guys say that the redness isn't really on the surface of the tomato. It's in the consciousness of the person looking at it, or the spiciness of paprika isn't really inside the paprika. It's in the consciousness of the person eating it. So in this way, Galileo strips the physical world of these qualities, puts them all in consciousness, and says, right, that's outside of the domain of science. That's in what he called the animated body. So he thought there's a sort of supernatural animation to the body where these qualities exist. So you get rid of all the qualities, you can describe everything else in mathematics. And this is the start of mathematical physics. So in Galileo's worldview, there's this huge divide between these two domains, the quantitative domain of science and the qualitative domain of consciousness. And so Galileo effectively gave science a narrow, limited, focused task. And that's gone really well, you know? And
right, absolutely. Like you say, it gave us our cell phones. It gave us so much that we use today.
Because we could then describe the physical world in mathematics.
And how things behave. Yeah.
I think now that we're in a phase of history. People always think they're at the end of history, but I think we're in a phase of history where people are so blown away by how well that's gone. And, the visceral effect technology has, it's like, wow, that you think that's everything. Of course. And it's of course one day going to explain consciousness. We've no idea how yet, but one day it will. But that's just, I think, misunderstanding the history of science. Yes, it's gone very well, physical science, but it's gone very well precisely because it was designed to exclude consciousness. And the fact that it's gone so well since it put consciousness outside of the domain of inquiry, doesn't mean it's going to be able to do well when consciousness is brought back in. So, I think if Galileo were to time travel to the present day and hear about this problem of explaining consciousness in the terms of physical science, he'd say, yeah, of course you can't do that. I designed physical science to exclude consciousness. That's the whole point. So, yeah. So it's just, I mean, I think I, as a professional academic philosopher, I spend a lot of time with fiddly technical arguments, which I think is important, but I kind of think they never really persuade anyone. What really persuades people are the big picture narratives. I think what persuades people to be materialist, the position I reject, is God, science is incredible. And what I'm trying to get people to see is another way of looking at the history of science. Yes, it's gone well, but it's gone well because it's always been aimed at a quite limited task, and it's explicitly not supposed to be a total theory of reality.
And so here we get to the hard problem of neuroscience. And the hard problem of neuroscience is how to unify the body and the mind, consciousness with the brain. And there are so many arguments, and nobody is agreeing right now. They're just incredible, incredible fighting. And I understand there's even been a history of academic myopia where certain departments wouldn't even want you to consider consciousness as a legitimate field of study, certain neuroscience departments. But it's never going to be put off the table. You can't unify reality without unifying consciousness and the mind. So we have the hard problem. And the hard problem, the way you outline it, which I think is, by the way, I love this book because I don't understand much about science, but I understand your book. And so if you wrote this for people like me, it's very successful because I can access the ideas very easily. It's a fantastic read. But you have, the problem's not going away. And you outline three different approaches. And we'll get to panpsychism, which I think is brilliant. And probably the only solution if we're ever going to figure out the hard problem. But what are the other two, and why do you think that they're not very helpful?
Yeah, that's really lovely to hear, because that, it's exactly what I was trying to do, to try and get out to a broader audience. And philosophers don't do this enough. And I think maybe it's because we're trained to try to produce these watertight arguments, and you inevitably... Right. You then go into all technicalities and cover all objections, and it gets really complicated. Right. And so actually, the reason I felt comfortable with doing this is because I'd already written my academic book in 2017, Consciousness and Fundamental Reality. So, because I think if you're going to write for a general audience, you've got to leave out some of the details.
Right.
But I think people feel nervous. They think, oh no, people will think I've got a terrible argument because I haven't filled in all the details.
And, right.
But anyway, yeah, so the hard problem of consciousness, this challenge of understanding how the brain produces consciousness, this inner world of colors and sounds and smells and tastes, and the great progress we've made in understanding the brain in the last few decades doesn't seem to have helped one iota in dealing with that. So yeah, when I studied philosophy in the dying embers of the 20th century, we were taught, basically there are two options here. Either you're a materialist, which is roughly the idea that we can just explain consciousness in terms of the electrochemical signaling of the brain, or dualism, the view that consciousness is non-physical, somehow separate from the physical workings of the body and the brain. And I just came to think that, both of these views, I initially wanted to be the materialist, and defended that view. Well, that's the scientific option, but I just came to see it's.
I love that statement. I wanted to be a materialist, but something led you away from it, and I imagine that's just following the logic, following logical language, I suppose. I'm not sure.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it's really hard, isn't it, to just the Enlightenment aim is just to follow the arguments and the evidence where they lead, but it's. It's pretty hard to do that as most people get invested in a certain viewpoint, and it becomes part of their identity. People talk about religion as a crutch, but I think a certain kind of scientism, a certain view of how science is supposed to be, becomes part of your identity. And, but yeah, so I guess, I mean, it's a big debate, but I think that the core of the problem in materialism, I think, is that physical science works with a purely quantitative vocabulary. Right. Since Galileo, that was Galileo's decision, his declaration. Right. Whereas consciousness is an essentially qualitative, quality-involving phenomenon. If you think about
right,
the
absolutely.
Smell of coffee, the taste of mint, the redness of a sunset, colors,
the juiciness of a carne asada burrito.
Absolutely.
How can science explain that?
Absolutely, yeah. Exactly. So these kinds of qualities that characterize every second of waking life, and I think you just can't capture those kinds of qualities in the purely quantitative language of neuroscience. If you could, you could convey to a blind neuroscientist what it's like to see color. And
Blind Mary. That brings up Blind Mary, which is a wonderful chapter. You don't need to go into it right now, but it's a wonderful explanation of what you're talking about. Colorblind Mary.
Yeah, that's one of the important thought experiments and arguments here that's much discussed. There's a whole book of essays on it called Something About Mary, which is literature. But I mean, just to, without going into the technical details, that I mean, I guess the way I would put it is. So there's a sort of descriptive, you're a writer, you're into writing, that there's a descriptive limitation, an expressive limitation to neuroscience, that this quantitative, austere vocabulary can't convey the qualities of experience. So why does that matter? Because I think that descriptive limitation entails an explanatory limitation. Because if suppose I wanted to explain consciousness in terms of neuroscience, what I'd have to do in writing my theory, I'd have to first convey those qualities, the colors, the sounds, the smells, the tastes, describe them in the language of neuroscience, and then analyze them in terms of more fundamental physical processes.
Right.
If you can't even convey them, you can't explain them. The whole explanatory project doesn't get off the ground. So that's the simple way, the way I like to introduce it. There's a descriptive limitation that I think entails an explanatory limitation.
Mm-hmm.
So I really think it's just, it's just not a coherent project to try and explain qualitative consciousness in this purely quantitative vocabulary. Oh, just finally, linking back to Galileo, I think we should have expected our current scientific approach to have this difficulty, but because it was kind of built in from the start. I think Galileo, I mean, I've got this provocative title, Galileo's Error, but I think Galileo is much more clued up on these things than we are
right
now.
Right, yeah. We don't really need to go too much into dualism, which is the idea that the mind and the body are separate. And these are probably, the majority of the people probably hold this idea to be true, that there's some, they have a soul, there's something eternal about them. They're not just this physical organism. But I would like to get into panpsychism, your version, particular version of panpsychism. But before we do that, I have to ask you a question. As a writer, I know that oftentimes just following the rhythm of the language, following the voice, often leads us to insights that we didn't even know we had, or that we were capable of. And we are sometimes stunned by what happens at the end of a sentence. We go, whoa. And I'm wondering, in your writing process, does that happen where you're following language and it perhaps leads you down pathways that you didn't expect? Are there surprises that happen based on following rhythm or voice?
I think I'm gonna disappoint you, actually. I think
because
I'm not one of these writers who sort of starts writing and in general, what I do is I go for a long walk and I plan exactly what I'm going to write.
Uh-huh.
And I just write it. And then what I love, I mean, I hate blank pages actually, but I love going over, once you've got it there, going over. But I mean, I suppose that's because my aim is not fundamentally, it is not to create something beautiful, although I hope it is beautiful. It's, to convey a certain idea and a certain argument. But I think I have developed, I hope, a sense of rhythm. So I think I bring in the rhythm and, right, you know, afterwards I just get it all out there on the page and then spend time kind of shaping it and getting the rhythm to get it more beautiful and accessible and nice language. And I quite enjoy that. But I think, I do like crafting it in that sense. But in terms of, as a philosopher, in terms of those kind of creative journeys and surprise, right, I think I find that more just thinking and, you know, going for long walks and, you know, I mean, I'm just thinking about it all the time, really.
Right,
and,
right.
I mean, I'm continuously kind of cross-examining myself, you know, imagining how my opponent would tear apart the argument. You know,
well, maybe that's a better way to understand it when you're walking. And, you know, because writers, we take walks too. It's fundamental to our whole experience. And as we're walking, we might be following an idea. And there's, I think, enough evidence that there is a thinker's high, you know, which is very similar to a runner's high, right? Where you're in that space for long enough to where suddenly it's like, whoa, here's a revelation. And maybe that's the surprise that I'm trying to get at, as opposed to actual writing. Maybe it's more thinking.
I think that captures it very well. I had this just yesterday, actually, where I'm co-writing a response piece to the duelist, Martina Niederrümlin, actually, for a volume who's in the University of Fribourg. And she's a great philosopher, but it's very dense, complicated writing. And I was just had to go for a long walk. And, you know, it starts off painful. And like, the analogy to the athlete is good. You know, I'm like, I don't want to think about this. It's too hard. I can't really get my head around this. And just thinking, and then, you know, you sort of pick up speed and then, I don't know what I'm doing with this. I know where I'm going with this. So I think that's more my creative. Well, that's more my sort of imaginative exploration, right, experimentation. But also, as I say, the crafting of the writing is a different kind of thing that's also creative, I think.
Right, right. And so when you write, after a first draft, how much revision is there? Like for me, you know, I write a first draft and then I revise for a year. I don't suspect it's the same for you.
No, not for me. I mean, I think a lot of people do write in a way where they revise a lot. But as I say, I mean, maybe this is a bit boring, really. But I tend to work exactly what I'm going to write. And yeah, and I write, and then when I've worked out what I'm going to write, I basically write 2 hours a day, 500 words an hour.
Wow.
Get a draft out in a week or two. And then, yeah, I mean, another couple of weeks going over it, which, yeah, I mean, can lead in new directions, but, right, or, you know, leads you to realize things didn't work out and then you need another long walk. But, but yeah, it's not really, as I'm not really one of these writers who experiments on the page. In general, I kind of experiment in the head and then
and then
stick it down when I just can't do it otherwise. I just can't.
No, that makes sense. Yeah,
I don't know what I'm. I just sit there and don't press any of the buttons.
In fact, if I had an idea of the philosophers, that would be it. Somebody who thinks as they take walks. You know.
Yeah.
But I don't want to keep you for long because I know you, you're kind of suffering a sore throat right now, but I just want to go ahead and make a segue into your basic idea of panpsychism and how that may solve the hard problem of consciousness.
Yeah. So, I mean, in our standard way of thinking about things, consciousness exists only in the brains of highly evolved organisms, and so exists only in a tiny part of the universe and only in very recent history compared to the history of the universe. But for the panpsychist, consciousness pervades the universe and is a fundamental feature of it. So, you know, a standard way of working this out would be that the basic building blocks of the physical world, perhaps electrons and quarks, have incredibly simple forms of experience, and then the very complex experience of the human or animal brain is somehow built up out of the simple experience of the brain's most basic parts. So you can think of it as an alternative research program rather than, you know, we've tried for decades to try and explain consciousness in terms of utterly non-conscious processes in the brain. Got precisely nowhere, in my opinion. You know, we've made great discoveries about the brain, but in terms of this problem of consciousness, I don't think we've got anywhere. The alternative research program is, rather than explain consciousness in terms of non-consciousness, explain very complex human and animal consciousness in terms of simpler forms of consciousness, simple forms of consciousness, which are then postulated to exist at the very fundamental level of reality. That's the basic.
So right now we believe that, well, scientists believe, not necessarily we, because I think everybody who understands science that aren't scientists are understanding just a metaphorical version of it, you know, a very cartoon version of reality, like, you know, the way we understand the Big Bang and the way we understand entanglement, we attach a meaning to it if we're not scientists, if we don't really know the math. But one of the things that that I think we understand about consciousness, or one of the things that we think about, the fundamental building blocks of reality of the universe are space, time, matter, light. But is your theory saying that one of the fundamental elements of reality is consciousness itself?
Yeah, absolutely. But it's important to qualify that a little bit. When people first hear about panpsychism, they tend to think the view is that particles have their physical properties, like mass, spin, and charge, and also these strange consciousness properties. And this, the physicist Sabine Hossenfelder, who's a very interesting theoretical physicist, but had a blog post critiquing panpsychism a year or two ago, and she was interpreting it in this way. And she was rightly pointing out that this is not a good theory because physics shows no sign of these non-physical consciousness properties in electrons. You know, they'd show up in our science if they were there. But she just misunderstood the view, right? The view is not, is not that the particles have their physical properties and these consciousness properties. The view is physical properties like mass, spin, and charge are forms of consciousness.
Right.
How do we make sense of that? Well, again, we're back to this Russell Eddington insight that actually, physics doesn't tell us what mass is. Physics tells us what mass does. Right. It characterizes mass in terms of attraction, gravitational attraction, and resistance to acceleration. It doesn't tell us what mass is. Mm-hmm. So that leaves open the theoretical possibility that mass just is a form of consciousness. So you said, is panpsychism the view that consciousness is also a fundamental feature of reality? Not quite. It's the view that it's the only fundamental feature of reality. Really, there is just consciousness. When you do physics on this view, you are studying forms of consciousness. Right. Now, you don't know that's what you're doing.
Right.
Because, as I said, it's like doing physics is like playing chess when you don't care what the pieces are made of. You just care what they do. You care what mass, as a physicist, you care what mass does. You don't care what it is. You care what a field does. You don't care what it is.
Right.
This is a proposal about what matter is. It's made up of forms of consciousness. So it's a way of integrating the reality of consciousness into the scientific story.
I really appreciate that you're bringing Eddington back into the conversation, because I have a great deal of affection for him. Even if it's just for his insistence on testing Einstein's theory of general relativity. That's just kind of like a little side note there. But I'm wondering how your approach differs from that which is proposed by Donald Hoffman in his case against reality, that his idea that, you know, reality is essentially a desktop, desktop icons. What we see is, you know, are you questioning the reality itself, and that, or is it
does it differ from that? Because it's really interesting idea, you know, that he proposes, but I'm not quite sure how others feel about that.
Yeah, it's a good question. Just on Eddington. I mean, it was Eddington that made Einstein an overnight celebrity with confirming his general
theory. Have you seen that movie with Eddington and Einstein? That's fantastic. What's that?
Yeah. Is it BBC? Is it, I think?
Yeah. That's probably what caused me to have more affection for him, because I've always knew about that, you know, that he was the one that confirmed it. But it's really a good movie.
Yeah. I was disappointed, though. It said at the end, after this, it sort of said something like, after this, Eddington didn't really do much and just liked religion. And
right. Sort of like, but you see, you're bringing him back to the table, and that's awesome.
Hoffman. So, yeah, I've had long conversation, about 3 hours long conversation with Donald Hoffman.
Really?
Actually. Wow. An audio series Annika Harris is putting together that should come out at some point.
Oh, yeah. I read her book on consciousness. Fantastic.
I was hoping he would. It's fantastic. She's contributing to this volume I talked about in the Journal of Conscious Studies. I was hoping Hoffman would, unfortunately couldn't, but a couple of his collaborators are contributing. So putting his point of view, you know, comparing and contrasting with my own. So, I mean, you know, firstly, I think Hoffman's work is absolutely fascinating, you know, and I might have some disagreement, but we're really early days in the science of consciousness, and it's good to get lots of different positions on the table. The difference between our views, I would characterize his view as a form of idealism. The philosophy, he doesn't tend to use that word very much, but I think really it is a form of the philosophical view, idealism, whereby the physical world either doesn't exist or isn't fundamental. There is some more fundamental story beneath physical reality. Mm-hmm. And for him, it's a consciousness involving one. He thinks these networks of conscious agents. So as you say, in some sense, the physical world we seem to experience is an illusion. So my view is, in a way, closer to materialism. I think the physical world does really exist. It's physics gets it completely right, at least regards its structure, its mathematical structure. I just think the physical world is constituted of consciousness. So the physical world is fundamental. Consciousness is fundamental. How can they both be true? Because they're the same thing. You know, going back to the Philip Pullman quote, we can't remember. It's like, you know, and another quote I like to get, another line I do actually, matter is what consciousness does. So,
oh, I like
you know,
that. Yeah.
My views, so I think that's the difference between the two views. Although his view is fascinating and, you know, worth pursuing, I suppose I'm not sure what the motivation is to think there's something deeper than physics.
Right.
And, you know, it seems to me he's setting himself a Herculean task because he's going to have to, I mean, I'll talk, so in this essay, the volume of essays, I'll write replies at the end. So I suppose that this is what I'll try to press. He will have to have these networks of conscious subjects that he thinks are at the fundamental level of reality. They will somehow have to capture the mathematical. We want to get out of that, the mathematical structure we get from physics, but also the fact that we are conscious minds that are human minds and animal minds experience that kind of three-dimensional world. And I mean, it's hard enough to get the equations of physics we already have. It's right. Going to be a Herculean task to get this more fundamental story that yields the mathematical structure of physics, yields our experience. That seems to me, you know, a Herculean task. I can't see I don't see what the motivation is for pursuing that task. Why not just stick with what physicists are giving us, the structure, the mathematical structure physics are giving us, and then fill it out with consciousness? So that's the difference. He thinks of this deeper structure beneath physics. I'm not persuaded. Right. We need to postulate that. The other objection I pressed to him. So he has this idea that we should think evolution We should think the world is not as we take it to be because we've evolved for fitness, not for truth.
Right, right.
So it's likely on that basis, you know, he thinks it's highly likely that we'll not be perceiving the world as it is. And what I put to him is, why doesn't that argument apply to our knowledge of other minds? You know, we've evolved an ability to make judgments about, you know, the experience that if other people are suffering or happy, or, you know, we have instinctive, you know, my baby at the moment, you know, as it instinctively understands right. the mental states of others. But it seems to me, on Hoffman's view, we should think, we should distrust those, we should think we're getting other people's experiences radically wrong. Maybe we should think that we don't even know if other people have experiences. So there seems to me a sort of a tension in the view that, anyway, I mean, I'm sounding very harsh now, which is what.
No, not at all. It seems like he likes people to be harsh on him, actually.
That's what it's all about, you know, having a conversation and, you know, pressing each other. And
I hope to get him on the show and have he would be my first cognitive psychologist. the book is Galileo's Error, Foundations for a New Science of Consciousness. It's incredibly readable, I just noticed Philip Pullman blurbed your book. I didn't even notice that until just now. But as the first philosopher on my show, I'd like to thank you and to say that one of the things that I'm beginning to realize as I dabble into lay neuroscience and lay physics and even lay psychology is ultimately science is returning to what philosophers have been saying for hundreds of years. You know, ultimately there's a lot of, for example, Hume in Hoffman, you know, and there's a lot of Kant, and there's a lot of all these ideas that are just kind of being revealed mathematically and in science. And I think that speaks very well for philosophy.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, I think science is incredible, and I think we're going through a phase of history where people are, you know, so blown away by how impressive it is. You tend to think that's everything. We've got the answers. We've got a way of getting the truth. We might not have all the answers, but we know how to get them. But I think in all sorts of ways, not just with consciousness, science has been so successful because it set so many things on one side. Right. It just had a limited focus task. And that's really the secret of its success. But there's all sorts of things that don't fit into it. I mean, not just consciousness, but also mathematical objects like numbers and sets. You know, these are things we know about not through observation experiments, right. but through kind of mathematical intuition. Facts about value, if you believe in such things. So I think there's things we know about not through the scientific method. And so in my view, the job of the philosopher that I think we're slowly remembering is a job of synthesis, taking all the things we know to be real from natural science, but also the reality of consciousness, the reality of numbers, facts about value or human agency, if you believe in such things, and synthesizing it all together in a single unified worldview. Right. What that kind of worldview building. And I think people are starting to say, yeah, you need to do that. It's not an optional task. And I think consciousness is the one that's most evident to people, that most presses people to the necessity of worldview building.
You know, one more thing, I just have to say this, when we were talking about following language, I know there have been cases where theoretical physicists have discovered equations that have led them to great insights that are new ways of seeing reality. And that sometimes that language of math is so elegant that they have to believe it. And they'll spend billions of dollars, billions of billions of dollars in resources just to prove the math. I find that kind of beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there are lots of, I mean, there's a whole number of assumptions undergirding science that are not themselves scientifically testable. For example, simple, elegant theories are more likely to be true. That's a working assumption of science. Yeah, you know,
absolutely.
For any set of empirical data, there's always an infinite number of theories compatible with it in principle. You scientists go for the simplest one, but you know,
Occam's razor, is that what it's called? Occam's razor?
Razor, yeah. William of Occam, great medieval philosopher. But why should simpler theories be more likely to be true than more complex theories? And you know, that's not something, you know, also that the future will resemble the past. That's a working assumption of science, that these laws, you know, it could be the laws that have operated up to now are about to stop and we'll get some new laws, but we assume that the future is unpleasant. So, and that there's an external world at all, you know, I mean, all that right. We can trust our senses, that we're not in the matrix. So there's a whole load of assumptions we have to make. I mean, this kind of, I don't know, Richard Dawkins type view that just look at science, that'll tell us all the answers. I mean, there's all sorts of problems with that. But most obviously that there's a load of non-scientific assumptions that you have to make to get science off the ground. I think increasingly people are starting to see this.
Yeah, you know, there are so many other things I could go off of just based on what you said, but I'm going to go ahead and let you go. I really appreciate you spending time with us here on Words on a Wire. The show will air locally first, and then it'll be on our podcast. But before you go, I need to find out how I could find your podcast so we could promote that and get people to listen to it.
Oh, yeah, Mind Chat. So it's a YouTube channel, Mind Chat. And I guess hopefully on many podcast providers. And so, yeah, so it's like, it's a guy who thinks consciousness is everywhere and a guy who thinks consciousness is nowhere. And we're just once a month interviewing scientists and philosophers of consciousness. And
it's important work that you're doing. So thank you. And thank you for Galileo's Error. I love it. It's a great book.
Oh, thanks so much, Daniel. I've really enjoyed the conversation. It's been a slightly different kind of interview to the one I have with this sort of slightly literary angle and stuff. And that's really fantastic. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too. Thank you.
I'm Daniel Chacon. I would like to thank my guest, Philip Goff, author of Galileo's Error and one of the only full-time philosophers that I know. Most people get paid for working. This guy gets paid to think, and I love it. I'll see you next week on Words on a Wire.